Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
G, 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 take me away.
Welcome to another episode of the Gary Hour. I'm your host, Gary Levitt. This is part two of my talk with entrepreneur Cosmo Jones. Part one is right below this episode, where we hear how he went from being a child actor on NBC to working some pretty dangerous jobs to starting several companies that we'll hear about now. Pretty inspiring stuff. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a musician, a podcaster, a filmmaker, or just like to take videos on your phone, go to the App Store and search for Future Moments, because they have an app that'll make your life simpler. Okay, check out the show notes for information on Cosmo, and you can subscribe and like this show, leave a review, email the show, all that fun stuff. But most of all, just enjoy.
What happened next? What led to your, because you're quite the entrepreneur, what led you to start your own company?
So this would have been 98, and by then I was already like really hooked on the web.
Mm-hmm.
It was still early days, and design was, it wasn't really a place you could do design, but the second you could, which I would say would be about like 96,
mm-hmm.
That's when I started to get into it. And you know, this web thing, it's no fad.
Yeah. You realized the internet was not going anywhere.
I realized that the internet was not going to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reasonably confident about that.
And so, at that time, it just recently went away from modems to maybe DSL? Right before cable?
No, we had one thing in between called ISDN.
Mm-hmm. All right, okay.
Which was just...
A little faster than
dial-up.
Right.
A little more stable.
Mm-hmm. So all this technology is, this hardware technology is making internet browsing become more commonplace.
Yeah, that and computers becoming more powerful and people figuring out that, you know, websites don't have to just be a bunch of text.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to get into the very first, like, user interface, user experience for web. And so I started taking on just like freelance clients. I had a pretty regular gig at this agency called the Strasburg Group in Santa Monica. And, you know, that was like, they were a fairly legit boutique agency that did a lot of travel stuff. And
were you doing graphic design or web design? Just graphic.
No, I was doing just graphic design. And that's, by then I had, you know, done enough work. I had enough skills. And the other thing that really got me the the constant work there was I was the one who knew how to keep all the computers running and network together and could handle like all the backups. We used to back up to this digital tape, you know, all the time. And so having all those technical skills also helped, because I wasn't the greatest designer.
Right.
So I think that really helped me keep a job as I got better at design.
Right. Do you feel like your musical education and musical skills helped this understand the technology in some way?
Don't think so.
No. Okay.
I really don't think I.
Because sometimes there's a mathematics to music where people that, especially people that studied music composition, music theory, there's like a math thing going on, exercising that part of your brain, where it can parlay itself into more technical things.
Yeah. You know what comes to mind is less that, more about getting really good at troubleshooting. Because when you have like a, this would have been the 90s.
Yeah.
Guitar rigs were insane in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
Like you did it. Now you can show up to a gig with your vintage looking Supro amp and a couple pedals and a guitar being a cool hipster band.
Yeah.
But if you were a serious touring musician, you had to have the rack full of gear. Your gear had to be at a certain level.
Right.
And you'd be lugging a couple cabinets along with it. Mm-hmm. And you'd have a pretty elaborate pedal board system. And there's just a lot of shit that could go wrong. And so you'd learn to troubleshoot things. And that was the same thing with computers and design. Is back then you spent a lot more time fixing issues with the computer while you were doing design,
because
it wasn't as stable as we enjoy today.
So you're constantly having problems and learning to solve them.
Yeah. You were always up against issues of running out of drive space. You were always up against maxing out your processors and just like ending up in these endless loops when you're trying to make Photoshop do something a little bit bigger than the computer thinks is
right, and
feels like doing.
And that's kind of the foundation of entrepreneurship, is seeing a problem and solving it.
Yeah. I think that is correct. You have to be somewhat of a self-starter, and you have to be willing to like take it all the way to solving the problem.
Yeah.
If I was one of those people that stopped in the middle of fixing a problem, I probably wouldn't have ended up making businesses or anything.
There's kind of a goal orientedness to it.
Yeah, it's all about here's the problem. The best outcome is I fix it as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I would go for, is best outcome if in a live situation is fix it as fast as possible. Best outcome when you're recording or in the rehearsal was, well, crap, I hope nothing broke. Let's make sure everything's okay. Let's fix it so I don't have to replace anything.
Right. So what was the first? So after that, you started getting into web design and you formed your own company.
Space Dog was the first company with my good friend Freedom, also a musician.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like I only did things with musicians.
And all the while, you were still playing music throughout this whole thing.
The whole time.
Yeah. So you really work in two jobs.
Yeah, I never really ever considered music a job. Mm-hmm. It never felt like a job.
Because it was it's an outlet.
Yeah, I love doing. I love playing. I like both parts. I like playing live and I like recording.
Yeah.
So I just enjoy the whole process. So it definitely didn't feel like work until later, like when you're playing other people's music. But to stay on track,
formed this. This is the first company that you formed.
Yeah. So we did a couple small sites, and then Freedom met this guy who worked for one of the early startups that had a lot of visibility. They were called JFax.
Mm-hmm.
They were the faxing for Jews? Software. Yeah.
We're Jews and we fax.
Kosher faxing. No, it was a competitor. Like, I think eFax came and ate them for breakfast. Like,
yeah.
Facebook took down MySpace. But back in the day, Well, JFax, I think, was one subsidiary of like J2 Communications. I think they had their fingers in a few things. Anyway, this guy had like a legit job, and he was kind of brought on as the guy who was going to run the business, and he was going to invest money into it.
Into your business, Space Dog.
Yeah, because Space Dog started with just Freedom and Myself, and so then it became Freedom Myself and this other dude. And we actually grew it into, something pretty remarkable twice. And I would say that 8 years from 98 to 2006, when I moved on, that was my degree in business that I never bothered to get when I was in school.
Yeah, you learned on the job.
Yes, I learned by making mistakes.
Uh-huh, yep.
Yes.
So you with that, you learned about investors. You learned about growing a business, adding personnel.
Yeah. Like every mistake that we could possibly make, we would do in a spectacular fashion.
If you could share one big lesson, what would that be?
Well, yeah. Make sure you know who you're going into business with, and make sure that you've got all your paperwork sorted in advance, no matter how big or little your goals are. Just making sure everybody's expectations are understood and documented in a way that, you know, can't come back to ruin the day.
And your intentions, like where you want to see the business end up.
That too, yeah.
Right.
All that stuff.
You can kind of learn that from a band.
Totally can. I mean, I should have figured it out. I think the one thing that's missing is usually your band was your band of brothers, and there was never like one necessarily business guy in the band.
Yeah.
But that's not true when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone
kind of takes their role.
Everyone takes their role, but the people that have the most power in a band, which you learn later, and you learn it's the business side of it, are the people, it's either the lead singer or the people who are writing the songs. They have all the power, especially if you're either a session musician, or you get picked up. You're going to be the first guy they get rid of,
right?
Or the first guy to realize, hey, I'm not making as much money as everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I learned that in college with my college band. We were together for about 4 years, and we got courted by EMI at the time, major label. The guy had us over his mansion. And he's basically not even offering us a full deal, but offering us a demo deal. You know, the label will pay for us to go in the studio, record a demo, see how we are in the studio. He loved us live. And it just, I didn't even know. I've been playing this band for 4 years, but half of us didn't even want to be on a major label. And I was like, wait, you don't want to be on a major label? Like, no. One of the band members in this meeting said, EMI, isn't that a subsidiary of some weapons manufacturer? To the guy. And the guy just like let him have it. He's like, well, what about your shoes? You know, you like Coca-Cola, you know, we can go on and on with this.
Yeah.
Casting blame. And then that was a big lesson for me, because it's like, wait, I never thought about asking everyone where we want this to go. You know, we were just playing shows. Like, well, what happens if a major label wants to sign us? We never ask that question.
Yeah.
And it's the same in business. Sure. Like, where, if you go into business with Freedom and he doesn't want it to grow, he just wants to keep it at a certain level, and you want it to get bigger and bigger, then you should probably talk about that.
Yeah. Definitely. Or at least understand, you know, create your own exit strategies so that you can maintain your quality of life. So knowing that, like, once it gets to a certain level, you know, maybe I want you to buy me out because this is not something I want to do for the rest of my life.
Or right.
However you want to set it up.
It's just, and I guess with him taking an investor, you know that he wants to grow it big.
Well, we both did. We saw this as an opportunity. We wanted to be able to get bigger clients and do bigger jobs. And you know, this was one way to get there. And that's the way we took.
And how did that end up?
Well, the short story is it was, you know, quite a roller coaster, because we managed to be one of the few companies that survived Y2K.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the
one
dot
of the
bomb.
Many companies that survived.
We managed to stay afloat where you know, all these
in
other,
the dot-com bust.
Yeah, yep. That was brutal. 2000 in 2001, that was a huge dip, but we hung on and we rebuilt it, and by 2005 we had partnered with Mendelssohn Zion, which was like a real legit ad agency. Mm-hmm. That did TV and print, and so ad agencies were buying up web design and development firms as fast as they could
to just have them as a separate department.
Yeah, I mean, it's either they have to start from scratch. It's much easier because we have no value. The only value we have is goes up and down in the elevator every day. That's the equity you have in a company like that, which is also something I didn't realize till later.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, okay. So Spacedog, you know, it has a portfolio of clients and it makes money on a charging for services.
Right.
So if there are no clients, it doesn't make money. If someone wants to buy Spacedog just to get to the clients, that has a very finite value.
Right.
So if you go into an agency like that with a goal to have a big exit strategy, mm-hmm. I mean, it's often not the case unless maybe you can get acquired. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the one time where we should have been making more money, and that's kind of where things went wrong. Is that's when our investor partner kind of pulled a fast one and like went back in time and said, well, because God, I don't even know how to unravel this in a short way, but basically he just used some situation from the past to show how anything that we had equity in was gone, and there's a different company that Mendelssohn Zion is acquiring, and he has 100% of the shares, but he is very generously going to give us shares in this new company. And so that began an epic battle over, well, wait a minute, because Freedom and I are thinking, we started this. This is our company. We've always thought of it as our company.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if anyone should have a lot of shares in the company, it should be us.
Yeah. And was the investor even doing any of the work?
Oh, the documents that he had were a joke. I mean, when I finally, in 2006, hired a real honest-to-gosh attorney who knew what he was doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, he looked over all the stuff and he wanted the case because he's like, yeah, this guy is a scumbag. And I remember him telling me, going, yeah, this is some straight-up bullshit.
He's pulling a fast one on you guys.
Yeah, he's like, this stuff is so far from professional, so mm-hmm. far from legal. You have all these emails going back and forth that show the intent of what was supposed to mm-hmm. happen. And we could never get this guy to like get the doc. It was always, he was so good at selling. That's one of the reasons we get clients. And he was so good at managing people
right.
that he just like managed you right out of it. And we were getting, you know, bigger. We did some huge jobs. We put like airlines on the web. We did Qantas and we did Air Pacific. I think we did Carl's Jr. We did.
And he got those people because he's a good salesman.
Yeah, he's an excellent salesman. And
so he tried to pull some legal stuff where you guys didn't own any shares of your company?
Well, we thought that it was, you know, we each still had like essentially 33%, you know, the original right. three.
But that was documented when you went into business with him, right?
Right.
Okay.
At some point, we didn't know that Spacedog LLC had somehow mysteriously become Spacedog Inc. Like, literally, the name didn't even change.
But the Inc. and the LLC is different.
Two different
this
corporations.
This is the exact same. This is how the Rolling Stones lost their publishing for the U.S.
Yeah, I would like to think that everything I do is copying the Rolling Stones. But that one, I
you're basically
know.
Mick Jagger.
Yeah, no, I'd say I was more the Keith.
So he
Richards.
he pulled this fast one on you where he switched the name at some point?
Yeah, he just redid the paperwork. He was always bolstering the paperwork to look good for a possible acquisition. So he was pretty good at
so all he that did stuff. Try to pull a fast one just like that.
Yeah, I mean, probably somewhere in his lizard brain, he thought because it was all business and we didn't bring anything up, he probably thought that it was somehow okay.
Right. That's I think it's Alan Klein, that lawyer, that's what he did with the Rolling Stones. When he brought them to the U.S., it was Rolling Stones U.S.
Oh, interesting.
And they didn't realize that that's a wholly, totally different thing, company, than the Rolling Stones.
Oh, man.
So he owned, like, Keith Richards, they didn't get any money for Satisfaction. Like, whenever you hear Satisfaction on the radio in the United States, it all went to him.
Well, they got their revenge when the Verve stole that sample, and then they got all that Verve publishing. So, you know what? The Stones are going to be okay. But, yeah, that's still...
So your first company is like a big lesson, big learning lesson.
Because
you almost
got
screwed.
Yeah, I mean, and I took it much harder then. Now I look back and I realize,
you probably took it personally.
Oh, I took it personally. I also thought there was a lot more value in the company than there really was. Because that's what I go back to. That's what I learned, is the value of the company is, in a company like that, is keeping the talent there. And ultimately, if it would have, I mean, it fell apart like 5 months after I left because four key people left with me.
Right.
Freedom left, our CTO left, our CMO left, and another high-level programmer. So it pretty much just like took the whole, it'd be like a company today removing the entire C-suite except for the CEO.
This is after the acquisition.
Yeah.
How did they not have it in the contract that if we do acquire you, these core people have to stay on for a minimum of 3 years?
They didn't have that in the contract. And furthermore, that's what allowed us to leave, is because he had never gotten a proper contract. Because by then I was finally fucking smart enough to know, oh, I'm not signing an employee contract. And I didn't really have a grasp of why. It was because of the word employee. And that's, you know, where I dug in and I'm like, I'm not an employee.
Right. You're owner.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's when you realized the legal jumbo he was pulling on you.
Basically, I would never sign that.
Right.
If I had signed that contract,
yeah,
I would have been in a far worse position than I was.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to leave, and I knew when I left, even if I didn't say a word or try, there was going to be clients that would not stay there that are going to want to
come with you.
Come with us. And our CMO had a friend who had just started talking to her about maybe doing some work for MTV.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew that that was a possibility. And our CMO had also brought in Stila Cosmetics and what was it? Oh, and then we had an energy drink, like an organic energy drink. And I personally had done all the work on that. I mean, I did the branding, the packaging, the website, all this stuff. And like no one else touched it. So there's no way that they were going to stay there. So that's what happened.
So you all bailed.
We all bailed.
And you did get money from the buyout, right? When they acquired you.
No, we didn't get a dime.
You didn't get anything?
No.
Did your investor get anything? When you got acquired, I would imagine you getting bought out.
We basically got good salaries for once, and healthcare,
right,
and the promise of equity. I honestly don't know if I don't even say his name because it's just like I don't want to give this guy any credibility. But I will tell you, he went on to become the president of MySpace way after MySpace was a joke.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say the president of the United States.
No. God. Well, yeah. I guess there are worse people out there. So I don't know if he got money. He probably got maybe something up front. But, you know, I think it was also a risk because all of a sudden, you know, this ad agency is suddenly paying for... how many of us were there? I think by that time, we probably brought 12 people with us.
Yeah.
And then we had ended up hiring more people. And I think by the time we were rolling out of there, we might have been about 50 people strong.
Wow. So they grew it.
Yeah. And I watched the quality go down the toilet.
Did they keep the name? Towards the end. So Space Dog was gone.
So Space Dog, no, they kept the name because we left and mm-hmm. we started our own company. And
was that Highly Evolved?
That's Highly Evolved.
Company? Yeah.
And Stila came with us and the energy drink came with us.
But that investor that tried to scam you, he was gone.
He tried to sue us. And that's, you know, when I had that attorney. And
the good attorney.
And our attorney basically destroyed them in probably three letters. Three mm-hmm. back and forth letters. That's as far as it got. And
didn't even go to court.
No, they gave up because we threatened to countersue, and we just had all this evidence, and it really made this guy not look good to the two primary partners at Mendelssohn Zion.
Right.
And there was also, these guys were older guys too, and they were looking for their exit strategy. So, what ended up happening is Japan's second largest agency, Hakuhodo, ended up buying Mendelssohn Zion essentially. And then like 5 months after we left, I mean, Space Dog just didn't exist anymore.
Nice. So with Highly Evolved, it was basically the same company, different name.
Yeah, it was, we wanted to go back to what we did in the beginning, you know, where we had less clients, but we had, were able to do quality work.
Right.
That's when things were falling apart, where we were taking on clients that I just could not give a wet shit about. Like, we had Secure Horizons, which is like uh-huh. insurance for the elderly or something. There were brands that we'd work on, and I was like, this isn't cool or cutting edge.
Right, right.
This isn't how we got into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing we weren't building was any kind of real intellectual property. Like, anything that could make money without you having to sit there and work right. by the hour.
Right. And that's what you want. That's what your aim, you're going towards passive income. That's basically what you wanted, right?
Yes. And, you know, we thought that the way we were going to get that was by, you know, like creating sites. We try to create our own sites and different things like that.
Mm-hmm. So were you able to grow that company without the salesmanship of that investor?
Yeah, because by then we had the portfolio and had a bunch of relationships.
Right.
And we also got MTV. And they became... that just allowed us to work on any Viacom property because we became this Viacom authorized agency.
Right.
So
you're in the club.
Yeah, in a very evil club. So that meant that anybody that needed any digital done, you know, they only had X amount of companies. So we would often get like an RFP, bid it out, and we got a lot of
You got a lot of work to it. Yeah, they own a million different companies, I would imagine.
Yeah, they had so many properties, and
so what happened to Highly Evolved? How did that end?
Well, that, you know, that kept going really almost another 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think just kind of life happened to everybody. Chris and Seth, both of our programmers, they and their families just wanted to get out of LA. They moved to Portland, so they were working remotely for a while. Mm-hmm. And then they separated and made their own company just doing development. Mm-hmm. And then we'd hire them out, and it Highly Evolved just really became Freedom and myself acting as consultants for different things.
Mm-hmm.
And then Freedom got really into, you know, this idea of creating these like kind of political watchdog sites.
Mm-hmm.
And so he really wanted to pursue that, and
interest changed.
Yeah, but we've been friends since, you know, we were in an early band together called 689 in like 1990.
Uh-huh.
So we've been friends forever. So this was unlike the previous situation, which was, you know, very
tumultuous.
Hostile and yeah. tumultuous. This was really chill. It was, mm-hmm. it was more like, I'd say the last 2 years of Highly Evolved, if I would say Friedman and I probably didn't even work on the same project except here and there. Like, right. He would take on some stuff just enough to so that he could continue working on. He was more of a programmer, so he'd do some back end development or something, and then I just started like essentially working for myself.
Right. And then what did that bring? How did you end up buying Bedrock in a 40,000 square foot building?
That was like in 2009. You know, after doing Highly Evolved and saving up some money and whatnot, I was still going hard at music.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing is when you work for yourself, you realize that, oh, that's pretty awesome if you can create a situation where I can still make music a priority whenever I want it to be a priority. Yep. Or wherever I can.
Mm-hmm.
So
throughout all of this, you're still making music. Gigging.
From 1996, when I really just started doing freelance design, you know, that was the last time I ever cashed a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, either working for my own company or just working as a freelancer, building my own business. So 2009, I was looking to get another rehearsal spot.
Mm-hmm.
I had come back from working like a really big gig in New York, that paid really well. It was like a long-term consulting gig. It was for Zagat.
Yep.
And
Then you were looking for a rehearsal space for your band.
So yeah, once that job was finished,
yeah.
And Zagat ended up getting acquired by Google.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of them.
Zagat?
Google?
You've heard of Google?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're supposed to be something else.
I think they'll be pretty big someday.
Who knows? I think AOL's gonna.
So you're looking for a rehearsal space back for your music, like a monthly rehearsal.
I was looking
space
for a lockout space, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, because I was working in New York, I gave up my spot at Downtown Rehearsal.
Mm-hmm. Which was a big rehearsal space in LA?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was in downtown LA. It was in a super scary, dodgy part.
Yeah.
And it was in this old crappy building with one freight elevator that would often go out. It was the second, third, and fifth floor of that building.
Mm-hmm.
So it held like 200 bands, probably. Mm-hmm. Maybe more. I don't know. Because a lot of times you'd squeeze 3+ bands to a room.
It's a strange spot to have rehearsal space because it's so sketchy down there and there's homeless people wandering around all over the place.
Well, when
it's kind of abandoned too.
Yeah, when I was first there, there weren't even homeless people because there were no like even like gas stations or liquor stores or anything else around.
Mm-hmm.
So like it was commercial. So 5 p.m. it would just become a ghost town after
right.
that. You know, except for this one building,
yeah.
7th and Santa Fe. And so when I came back, I called him to get a room. And I thought because I'd been there for so long, you know, and I knew the guys running it, they'd either find a room that wanted to share or something. You know, I thought, well, they'll at least want to talk to me. I couldn't even get a call back.
Yeah, no clout.
I had zero clout.
They had no customer loyalty.
And no customer loyalty. couldn't even figure out what was going on. It's all I could do was call. They didn't have like an office. It wasn't like I could go down there and,
right.
You know, it's like you had to catch them when they were around. And
they
so
pissed
they just,
off the wrong person.
No, it's just like
did you put them out of business? Are they out of business now?
That ironically, that building is gone. They had two buildings, and
uh-huh.
and yeah, that one. They lost that building, and by then Bedrock was really well established, and we already were full, and we had a huge waiting list. But I remember our waiting list like ballooned. We had like probably like a 600 email, like email list of
yeah.
people that signed up because they were waiting to find out about getting a lockout. And I, you know, by the time
So wait, are you telling me if they returned your phone call and got you a room, you might not have ever started Bedrock?
I might not have started Bedrock. Yeah. So out of desperation, I'm looking for another space. And a friend of mine, Adam Aronson, who's a great, awesome drummer, he's played with a bunch of different people. Early days, he played with Thrill Kill Cult.
Mm-hmm.
Literally a cult classic. And then he went on to play with a bunch of other bands. And I think the last one he was in was We Are Scientists. Great guy, great drummer. You know, scrappy, always managed to make things happen or whatever. And so he turned me on to this building that some people had gotten the lease, and they wanted to do, like, this weird ass idea that they got when they were in Seattle of doing like a brew pub that was also like a rehearsal spot.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really needed a rehearsal spot. And so when I was talking to them, I was thinking, and I was looking at it, and I was thinking, you know, if this was done right, if this had all the things that I hated about downtown rehearsal, that I think you could fix.
Yeah.
How hard could it be? It was really me saying, okay, I'll jump into this because I see this opportunity, and I'm really confident that if you treat people nice and mm-hmm. you have decent gear and you have a vibe,
mm-hmm.
People are gonna use your place over other places. So.
Yeah, your rehearsal building, it's first of all, it's in Echo Park, which is a desirable location. It's where a lot of musicians already live.
Yeah, because the digital delay is free in Echo Park. Thank you.
We'll edit that one out.
Please do. I'm so sorry.
But yeah, you created a community, and I remember that about downtown rehearsal. There's no vibe. There's no community. You feel like you're getting ripped off for some reason. I don't know why.
No, you're fighting over who gets to the elevator, and if a band's hogging the elevator, all you are is mad at the other people in the building.
Yeah.
Or if they're too loud. Like, we used to rehearse next door to the Melvins, and they were so loud.
They're loud. That
when they would rehearse, I mean, we couldn't even have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We would have to shout at each other, you know? And some of our songs had dynamics, so
right.
It was really quiet. There would just, you know, be thunder fuzz coming through the walls.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing, is why can't the insulation be a little bit better between rooms?
Right.
How hard is it to do that? Turns out it's pretty hard.
And musicians in these states are already, like, the wind is blowing against their sail. They're already treated like crap everywhere. They're underpaid, you know. So at least your home, which is your rehearsal space, you'd want to feel good about it.
Yeah, and that's the one thing people would do at downtown. You know, when you're either a session guy or you're playing with a bunch of different people or you're auditioning for bands, you get to see a lot of rehearsal spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a unwilling expert at hourly rehearsal, lockout rehearsal. I've been in every situation you could think of. I've rehearsed in public storage facilities.
Yes.
I mean, I've basements, whatever type of rehearsal situation you can think of, I've probably done it, and worse.
My college band rehearsed in a public store, in a storage space, which is rough.
Everything plugged into the extension cord that you've got, the one overhead light.
Strange hums, pissing in buckets in the corner. It's not good.
Yeah, it's unsanitary at best.
Yes. So you started this thing, and you basically knocked out a bunch of rehearsal spaces.
Yeah, so again, thanks to my 8-year unofficial business degree,
yeah,
I knew that the people that had the lease on the building, I read their business plan. And after talking with them, I realized, oh man, these people are they're felony stupid. None of this stuff is going to work.
Uh-huh.
But I negotiated a deal because, you know,
the building.
Yeah. Well, not at first. At first, I negotiated a deal with them just to sublease a chunk of space.
Okay.
And then that's where all of my skills, life skills, design skills, marketing skills, and musical knowledge, mm-hmm. it was just kind of like a perfect storm coming together, because I had all the tools necessary to build like a good brand. And so they didn't even have the name. They were called ER Pro LLC. Uh-huh. That was their corporate name. We came up with the name Bedrock, and I did the branding, and I started the Bedrock Rehearsal LLC all by myself. And I told them, like, I was not dishonest at all. I'm like, I can't, until your paperwork makes sense, we can't combine businesses.
Right.
And they really couldn't argue with that, because that's just the way it was. So it got to the point where their plans were really crumbling. Like, everything that I was certain we would run into at some point ended up even being worse than I imagined. Like, I knew it was going to be difficult because of liquor licensing to get a brew pub and a rehearsal thing in the same place.
Yep.
But the building's technically two addresses smushed together.
Uh-huh.
And they had me believe that there was a path forward because they are technically two separate buildings. And if we made this one just the brew pub, and they had some other crazy ideas. Like, they wanted to have, at first it started out, it was going to have a hotel in it. And because it was a huge building and it was two stories.
Yeah.
And there was all this space. But they just had some really dumb ideas that never came to pass, thank God. So when their stuff started to crumble and they weren't able really to make the lease payment, you know, by then I was taking up quite a bit of space in there, and Bedrock itself was starting to do well.
Right.
You know, by then we had the recording studios, we had the hourly rehearsal studios. I had opened a repair department, because the smartest thing you can do if you've got a facility is have your repairs in-house.
Which is great for musicians, because you rehearse there, you could leave your gear where you rehearse to get it repaired.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
But honestly, the value came from having a guy who could fix all of our gear.
Mm-hmm. And having a good guy.
He eventually became my business partner. Yeah. I like gifted him equity because he worked his ass off and he brought so much to the table.
Yeah.
And now he runs the place.
And you're...
So I don't have to.
You don't have to do much.
I don't do anything anymore.
Yeah.
And I only because I'm in New York. If I was in LA, I'd be more involved, because I just love being there. The vibe's great.
Yeah.
I love all the people that work there. And,
yep.
It's just awesome. So,
do you own that building or did you lease it?
No, the building was leased, and I was always afraid to sign a commercial lease because you have to put all your personal stuff up.
Oh.
And, you know, at that time in 2009, I had just started...
2009 is the worst time to start a business, because that's when everything crashed. That's just when, 2010, it started to kind of get better.
Yeah, but if I see you read stuff. I see Freakonomics over there. sometimes at the bottom of the market is the best time to start a business.
Mm, right.
You know, landlord's willing to work with you.
Right.
There's a lot of things you can do in a depressed situation. So
you have a little more leeway.
Yeah.
So what do you do in that situation? Because you're obviously investing a lot of money in insulation and rooms. And...
Well, that was the thing. I was smart enough to invest in equipment and stuff that I could turn around and sell if things didn't work out.
Right.
I refused to put any money into the building because, you know, I'm just really giving you guys rent here. So they paid to build it out.
They paid to insulate soundproof each room?
Yep.
You got them to do that.
That was part of the deal. They wanted to build out the rehearsal studios. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted it to be all one company, but they were essentially just managing the lockout studios.
Wow.
And by that time, I was my company was doing all of the services.
Mm-hmm.
And I had brought all those people in, and I have one other partner who was running the recording part of it.
But the people that own the building, why would they...
Okay, so here's what happened, is when these people started to run out of money, and
the people that own the building?
No, the people that got the lease on the building.
The brew pub.
The brew pub people. Yep. Couldn't make the brew pub happen, ran out of money, couldn't finish building out in order to rent out to more bands to then, you know, make the lease payment. And all of their, everything was just like, it was a shit show. And so the owner of the building came to myself and Phil and Kamran, who are now my partners, and was like, okay, here's the situation. Is like, do you guys want to lease the building? Because we're taking them to court and they're getting kicked out. But mm-hmm. clearly you guys, it turns out you guys own the name and the business and the phone number and everything that makes this a business. And, you know, what can we work out here? And I just refused to sign a lease because, you know, at that time I owned a house. I had equity in a couple businesses right. as well. And I didn't want to risk any of that for something that I started, you know, just to see if I could do this. And yeah. while I really enjoyed it, I didn't want to take that much of a risk. So we ended up working out a different kind of deal where we essentially managed the building. So we're not responsible for the upkeep on the place, which hugely expensive.
So they manage the building.
Yeah, the owner of the building.
Right.
They own the building outright.
Yep.
And so anything that breaks, like the AC or electrical, or, you know, we've had all kinds of things go wrong, mm-hmm. you know.
And they have to take care of all that.
Yeah, but they're equipped to do it.
Right.
They own a bunch of buildings. That's the business they're in.
Right.
They're you know, they have a buy and hold on.
But my question is, why would they pay to soundproof all those rooms?
That's why it's confusing. Is they didn't build out those rooms
right.
That I'm talking about. It was the people that had the lease. They were building out. Yes.
Oh, okay.
They were building out all the rooms.
Right.
And I was just starting to occupy more and more of them because right. I could guarantee them regular rent.
Oh, so you're paying money to the brew pub people.
Yeah, I'm essentially subleasing.
Subleasing, right.
Yeah. So when that all fell apart, then that's when the owner of the building came to us and we worked out this deal, which I was much more comfortable with. Because the best case scenario is if we could have bought the building.
Yeah.
But it would have been somewhere between $4 or $5 million.
And then you have to upkeep it all.
Yeah.
Right.
And...
But with this, you want to make sure you have a nice long lease because you're investing all this time and money.
Exactly.
That if it's gone in 2 years, you don't even have time to recoup after you bought all that gear.
Right. Well, this was 3 years into it. So we had already acquired quite a bit of gear mm-hmm. over that time. And we were just lucky because of the zoning laws in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So that building used to be a jewelry manufacturing plant, has no windows. It's just this big, solid brick building.
So no, it could never be residential.
It could be, but the last person that tried to take something that was zoned in the way that this building was, it took them almost 10 years to get it rezoned. Whoa. And those are those condominiums you see. If you're familiar with Los Angeles, there's a bunch of condominiums that went up on Glendale Boulevard by the 5 Freeway. Mm-hmm. And it took... It,
you a know, beautiful it was, place to live.
Wonderful. So that freeway fresh air.
So do you have a nice long lease, I hope?
So we don't have a lease because I refused to sign a lease. Uh-huh. And I knew that the building couldn't really become something else very easily.
Right.
And so we worked out a different kind of deal. And it's you know, more based on performance. And we're getting them way more rent than they would have gotten if they... had leased the building.
Okay, so it's a win-win.
Yeah, they're happy, but they're real estate people, so they're always looking to see, you know, can you guys raise the rents?
Yeah, they want to get the most that they can get.
Of course. Yeah. Well, that's their business model. I get it. So, you know, sometimes that becomes a point of contention because we're always on the musician side. That was one of the reasons we started it, is the other part of it is it had to be affordable too.
Right.
You know? And it's turned into now it's like we service just tons of touring bands. We have, you know, mostly pro clients. You know, when it first started, like the weekends and nights were packed, mm-hmm. you know, now it's busy like Monday through Friday during the day.
Yeah. And you have solid income with the monthly rentals. People are there for.
Yeah. So there's over 100 lockout rooms. Yep. They're all full.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we managed to build out the rest of the space. Is we were telling the landlord, look, you know, if you subdivide these remaining things, if you do it right, you know, we'll get bands in here, and they'll pay a bit more than they were paying at Downtown Rehearsal, but they'll get something out of it because they'll be in rooms that have better soundproofing. They're air conditioned.
Right.
And you know, you're in this cool community. We have parking and it's in a safe neighborhood. Every band that I played in that had like a female singer or a female musician, I just remember so many times where they'd be coming to Downtown Rehearsal and it's like they didn't want to walk from their car to the building alone, and couldn't blame them. That was
Or the bathrooms are disgusting.
Yeah. Oh my God.
No toilet paper ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the worst things happen in those bathrooms.
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah. So this is finally your passive income. I mean, it just runs itself. There's high demand. You don't really have to do much. You have someone running it.
Yeah, we took it as far as we could, and they're still building. You know, we have a rental department, so we found ways to make money that didn't even require the building as much.
Right.
Like when space was full, you start getting creative, figuring out how you can provide other services, and then just like keeping an eye on what people really need.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just like every other rehearsal place stoically sticking to this is what we do, this is how we do it, we just started making changes. We realized, you know what, a lot of touring musicians now don't necessarily need a recording studio, but they do need a place where they can like plug in their laptop and have speakers and a monitor in mm-hmm. a controlled environment and be able to do overdubs. So we created these writing rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And those turned out to be great because, you know, it's like labels will pay for those. They'll pay for writers to go in there sometimes for weeks at a time.
Yep.
And then we also got into it gets used for as a film location spot all the time.
For mixing film?
No, not at all.
Oh, for shooting location, yeah.
Like, I mean, and it'll be something not even related to music. It'll be some skincare brand that just wants to shoot a commercial in a recording studio.
But you also, you got a pretty well-known artist to paint the whole building.
Yeah.
Now, that was a marketing decision.
That was just a cool thing to do, but yeah, it certainly made it so that everyone knew that building, and it doesn't have our name on it except just on the awning in the parking lot,
right,
which you can't even see from the street,
right?
So everybody knows Bedrock from that massive mural that a company, an art collective called Circle with a Y, CYRCLE, these brilliantly talented artists.
They do stuff all over the world. Big.
Yeah, and this is, I believe, if I have the story correct, it's one piece of eight pieces that all have a collective meaning and are part of one big piece that's scattered across.
Now, whose idea was that?
Well,
because that's a pretty brilliant idea to take this big building and make it such a visual experience.
I mean,
everyone's going to talk about, oh, did you see that huge building with this beautiful mural all over it?
Yeah, I can't take credit for having the idea to go find a muralist. It was more about we ended up having a canvas that's like in a location that 60,000 cars a day drive by.
Right.
And if you recall, I mentioned that Bedrock has no windows and no doors.
Right.
It has a door. But even the roll-up door is painted too. So we lucked out having the canvas. So when the opportunity came to us, we were like, oh, yeah.
Right.
And we talked the building owner into it. I mean, it's like, dude, you're getting a free coat of paint on the building, because it was sponsored by like Benjamin Moore, the paint company, and you know, they had some backing. So the only thing I had to pay for out of pocket was a scissor lift rental for a month.
Wait, the whole having that artist come paint that whole mural on the building was paid for by Benjamin Moore
and whoever sponsors, you know, whoever the patrons are of Circle. I think there's other people involved too. I know we got the paint from Benjamin Moore for free. Wow.
Nicely done.
Yeah. I mean, if someone paid for that mural,
yeah, that'd be
100,000. I don't know.
Yeah.
It took them a month to do.
Yeah.
These guys worked so hard.
It's intricate too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why I just, you know, sometimes just have to remember I just got very lucky doing what I do, because, you know, there's people that are so talented that they can turn a building into a piece of, like, I could never do that.
Yeah. Well, I'll put links in the show notes. So if you're listening, if you've made it this far, there's links in the show notes to check out.
If you haven't jumped in the tub and opened a couple veins.
So this brings us to now.
If you say so.
Was there a business in between that?
I did start with some people that I had worked with, one from MTV, and who had introduced me to someone that he knew. And so I was early on starting an influencer marketing company, which now is just a freaking buzzword.
Yeah.
But at the time, this would have been 2010.
Influencer marketing company. So basically you find people, celebrities and notable types to market for companies.
Yeah, essentially that's what it boils down to today, is it's connecting brands with influential Instagrammers and
right.
Facebookers and Tweeterers.
Yes. I think Kanye West will tweet your company for, last I heard, it was $50,000 for one tweet.
It can go a lot more than that.
Yeah. He's probably more now. This is a few years ago.
It's ridiculous what brands will pay for that. And if you actually look at the analytics, that's one of the dumbest ways to spend money, because yes. a tweet comes and goes so fast, and there's not a lot of engagement. And that's why influencer marketing works, is because someone who has an Instagram following of 10,000 to 100,000, they post something, you know, like 25% of the people are going to interact with it. They're going to like it. They're going to share it.
Right.
Kim Kardashian tweets and it just goes by so quickly.
BuzzFeed too. I mean, a lot of the BuzzFeed articles are actually product placements. Very subtly done.
It was early days for that. And so my part of that was helping, well, besides doing the branding of the company and the site and the look and feel, and helping build out all the, like how we do proposals and whatnot, I was working on the technology side of it, trying to set up more of a platform that was the automated side of it. Mm-hmm. But it really turned out that, we still work together now. Like I do campaigns now and use this company, which is called Zomad. And, you know, we do some pretty great things together.
Do you have equity in Zomad?
Yeah.
Okay.
So because I was one of the first people on, even though I didn't start the company, I have a little bit of founder's equity. Plus I really like the people doing it, and I want it to succeed. So I'd, you know, do anything for those guys.
So that kind of brought you into your current company, which is...
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Brand marketing.
Yeah. So that, along with everything else that I was doing, kind of evolved into what's now the boathouse. And that's because I met a guy who's a really brilliant storyteller and director and just understands the video and broadcast side of the business for digital and traditional so well. It's like I could kind of go back to what we almost had at the last throes of Space Dog and Mendelssohn Zion, where we were doing like pretty big integrated campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this will give you another reason to hate me. We were responsible for that Paris Hilton Carl's Jr. campaign.
I don't remember that. What is that?
You don't remember the one? It was for the spicy jalapeno $6 burger, and she's crawling all over a Bentley.
Oh, yeah, and it was very sexual, right?
Yeah. Let's just say the writing on this commercial was non-existent.
Right, right.
It was,
it was like a juicy burger and the liquid poured down.
Yeah, because this was coming off the if it doesn't get all over the place, it doesn't belong in your face campaign.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And so this is when Paris Hilton was at the apex of her Paris Hiltonness. Mm. And the catchphrase, if you recall, that's hot.
Right. Which she tried to patent or trademark or something.
Probably.
Like that. Yeah.
And yeah, so Carl Jr. got her to say that about one of their ridiculous burgers.
And you're responsible for that?
We're responsible for the website and the digital marketing side of that. And then, it was all under one banner, the commercial and everything, because we were Carl's Jr. and Hardy's, like, agency of record for everything, I think, at that time.
Uh-huh.
So
why do you keep, just to wrap this up, why do you keep working? I mean, you probably have enough from Bedrock and your other endeavors. What drives you? You're here in New York now. You started a new company, fairly new. It's growing. What's driving you?
It's growing like gangbusters. And I think it's because, we're getting like the type of clients that we've always dreamed about having.
Yeah.
Sometimes those dreams can turn into nightmares, but it's still good work. It's still visible work. It's also, we get an opportunity to really do things the way we like. And we're small enough that we only take on clients we think we can either we believe in the client wholeheartedly and mm-hmm. We want them to be the Robin Hood of their industry and take everybody by storm. Or, you know, it's a client like Apple who's, you know.
I heard of them too.
Yeah, you might have heard of them. They've made
so you enjoy what you do.
Yeah, I like building things and seeing mm-hmm. the result.
Mm-hmm.
There's still other things that I want to be able to build, and by taking on this client work, it helps finance the things where we don't have money.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll take an Apple gig, or we'll take, you know, we have RCN, which is an internet provider. We have quite a few good clients, and then we'll also take on people that don't have any money to spend.
Right.
We're helping a health AI platform because I think the CEO of the company is amazing. I think their platform is amazing,
right.
But they haven't really even fully launched yet. So they don't have budgets to do things, but we want to launch them in a big way. So we get to work on that because
are you
pull it off.
Are you aware, because like throughout this story of your life, there's one thing that leads to another. So as you're going through this company, are you aware that someone might cross your path that will kind of like spark something in you that might lead to your next company?
Well, I think it's about just recognizing the opportunities when they come up, the ones that really, really have legs. And it's also maintaining just really good relationships with people that you admire.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to keep a relationship because someone works at a certain place and they can, you know, potentially give you access to work. But if you can somehow make friends with people who you believe do things better than you do.
Right.
And you can make those connections. Those are the best because more challenging, interesting things
come. It's like that saying, you're only surround yourself with people that are better than you. You're only as good as the five people around you.
Totally. I mean, everything we do is of a team effort. It's not like one person carries the ball across the finish line. Mm-hmm. There's a lot involved, especially in some of these bigger campaigns, because they have pretty long tails to them sometimes.
If you had any advice to someone looking to start their own business, do you think you'd be able to parlay anything from your experience?
Well, we already learned the first rule of it, which is like document everything, know your expectations, know if you're in business with partners, mm-hmm. Know everybody's roles and responsibilities, mm-hmm. what value that has, whether it's an equity or if you're trying to take a salary against the company. And then know everybody's exit strategy or what they want to be when they grow up.
Right.
And it's...
vision, having the same vision.
It's also hugely important that you have a shared vision. Until you can get to a point where you're big enough that you can split off and kind of do other things. But yeah. Let's see. God, there's so many business tips that can roll through your head and cliches and everything. But I'd say the other thing is really try to like the people you're working with. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't go into business when you see an opportunity, but you really don't like either the person or something else that's connected to it. It's never going to turn out well.
Mm-hmm. That is very, very true and very wise. You learn a lot in bands. Bands, it's very similar.
It is.
A business with the bands.
You know, bands that get anywhere are mm-hmm. bands that treat what they do as a business and they're good at handling it.
Mm-hmm. And all this, throughout all this, you've kept making music.
Pretty much, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd say these days is where I'm the lightest on doing music, but I'm also the heaviest on being involved in a bunch of stuff. I mean, I'm even trying to help a music product get to fruition, mm-hmm. like an actual physical piece of hardware for musicians that I think solves problems every musician that makes music with a computer has.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, getting to work on something like that.
Do we want to divulge what that is yet?
Yeah, it's Pipes. Have I shared that with you yet?
Pipes. What is Pipes? Tell the listeners what Pipes is.
Pipes is a portable audio computer with a touchscreen interface that is, it'll outperform a laptop, but it just does one thing really well. You can trigger up to 20,000 samples mm-hmm. instantaneously. I can't say there's zero latency. There's zero detectable latency. The latency is like 4 milliseconds. So, mm-hmm. My friend Vince DeFranco, who is also an entrepreneur, and he is just an incredibly talented engineer, mm-hmm. both on the audio side and on the physical product side.
Yeah.
You know, he's done. Worked with like Prince and Stevie Wonder and Tool and a bunch mm-hmm. of cool bands that I admire.
So you're already starting another business here. This is what's happening.
This is something I'm able to do because, you know, I have the client work and then I can spend the other half of the time doing the stuff that I really want to do.
Right.
And Vince is amazing. He's the guy who invented the dimension beam or the D-beam. You probably, if you have any Roland gear in here, you might have the D-beam on there.
What is the D-beam?
That's that light sensor.
Yeah, it's like a theremin kind of thing.
Essentially, yeah. It's basically like a control voltage that changes instead of with a potentiometer. It changes mm-hmm. by the distance of your hand mm-hmm. to using infrared light.
All right, so you're already on to the next. Very inspiring, Cosmo. Thanks for sharing your life story with us.
Sharing is caring.
So your mom must be very proud.
Probably.
Does
she? She's still my biggest fan.
Yeah. From the start.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one thing, you know, to wrap it up, even though we started off on kind of like a rocky terrain. at the end of the day, no matter how crappy my piece of artwork is or how shitty my band was, my mom always thought it was great. She never held me back from doing that stuff.
She thought that NBC sitcom was amazing.
Amazing. So funny.
Thanks, Cosmo.
All right, bud.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.